Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 37 featuring, Gina, who are we featuring today?
Mr. Wes Ball.
Mr. Wes Ball is a director. He has directed things that we know very well, such as The Maze Runner, which is amazing. And he's doing the sequel to The Maze Runner, which is coming out September 18th in the United States, called The Scorch Trials. And I'm sure you guys have seen, if you live in LA, the posters are everywhere for that.
Yes.
The fact that we have Wes on the podcast is kind of surreal to me. And in fact, the way that happened, we talk about on the podcast. I'm not going to get into it right now. But I'd like to take the opportunity to talk a little bit about following us on social.
Yes.
Yes. So if you happen to be on social and you want to be on Twitter, you can follow Labs, which is, what's our Twitter account on Labs?
It is at @CG_Labs.
Yeah. And then we also have our Chaos Group Twitter as well,
yes,
which is
at Chaos Group.
At Chaos Group, yeah. And we're also on Facebook.
Correct.
And LinkedIn and Google Plus.
And pretty much everywhere.
Pretty much everywhere else. So you can find us anywhere you want to find us. You can also, if you're on iTunes and you're listening to us on iTunes, please make sure and rate us and give us a review or whatever you want to do. Let us know how we're doing. Love to hear from you. And that's it. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Obviously, slammed making this movie recently, but I'm catching up now, and somehow I came across your interview with Mike over Effects Guide.
Oh, Mike Seymour?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know him pretty well, and yeah, it's awesome. I've been listening to it. It's great.
Well, I turned the tables on him, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. He's now the interviewee.
Yeah, he was like, this is very strange. I could tell he almost felt a little uncomfortable about
really,
it.
Really,
that's
interesting, yeah.
But I liked it. So I thought it was...
Is he here?
No, he's in Australia.
Okay, you did over yeah, Skype or something.
Yeah, so we're starting actually already, just
cool,
so that way...
Just the way we like it. Drop right in the middle.
Jump right in the middle.
We don't need any hellos.
No, because what I figured is I always just do the intro at the beginning.
Yeah,
so
totally.
I listen to it, and then yeah, like, this is what we're going to talk about.
Oh, that's great. That's why I love podcasts. It's a conversation, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, especially now, I'm in this like mode where I'm just doing these press things, these press junkets.
Yes.
And it's these little bite-sized, like, you know, five-minute things, and you do like a dozen of them back-to-back. It's the worst. You get the same answer over and over again. You never get a chance to have a conversation. As soon as you try to, okay, that's it, cut. You know, you're like, ah. So that's why I love podcasts. I've been listening to them forever.
It's funny because one of the inspirations for the style of podcast, and if you listen to the Nerdist podcast,
yeah, sure.
My podcast is like a complete ripoff of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great. Yeah, he's really good, too.
He's really good, but
he's got some great people on.
And he does, and they're always like, oh, this is so nice.
Yeah.
And because they've been barraged by junkets.
Totally.
And it's, yeah.
You have to have a conversation. You go off on tangents and then come back around.
Right.
It's great.
I remember specifically the first time I was subjected to that. I'm sure you've got better stories than me, but it was, they were trying to get some snippet.
Yeah. Right, sure.
And so they put me in front of a camera
and
they had
the worst,
a person
yeah,
on the other side. So it was single camera, but they had a person interviewing me and I'm supposed to look at that person and he asked me this question 18 times.
Yeah, right. Until you say the answer they want, right?
It's like,
yeah,
you know, I was going to have a conversation.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it was very, very hard.
Yeah, there's something cool about it. You know, when podcasts started happening, especially like, you know, Twit and Leo and those guys, you know,
yeah,
that's where I kind of got into it. It's just something nice about seeing record people talk about things that they love. It's just, you don't get that anywhere else, you know.
Right.
Sometimes the radio shows, but yeah, it's just something fun about just kind of dropping in the middle of a conversation between people that just like talking about stuff.
Yeah, it's like you're there,
it's
right?
Cool. Yeah, I love it.
I think one of the things we talked about way long ago, well, not actually not that long ago, it was when we did a short film with Kevin, a bunch of CG guys called Vira RL.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Okay. Yeah, so that was a while ago,
So that was
that's
us
cool. That's awesome.
Doing that. And we were just sort of hanging around. And then what Lon wanted to do is like, I really wish I could just have a video camera of us talking while we're doing this thing and coming up with ideas. Yeah. And one of the inspirations was Jon Favreau's Dinner for Five.
Yes, totally. That was kind of almost like a podcast.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Totally.
And you basically felt like he made you feel like I'm at dinner with these guys.
Yeah, just having a conversation. Yeah, right. It's great.
Yeah,
so that was cool.
Yeah, it was
a good
one.
I like what Jon Favreau does, man. He's like a cool guy.
He is a cool guy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he's a challenging person to be with, but he's a very interesting guy, and he's got really good ideas. And I think his creativity is really about getting people to be themselves. And
I'm curious what Jungle Book's going to be like. I keep hearing a lot of cool things about it.
I hear a lot of interesting things. Yeah. It's going to be, and it seems a little bit, you know, he's not afraid to try, you know, we're talking about a guy who does, you know, Swingers and Elf, right?
Yeah.
So he's not afraid to reach out and do different
totally.
Things.
Yeah, and it's cool. You know, it seems to understand effects enough, or at least to have really talented people surrounding him, mm-hmm. surrounding him that he can pull out some cool stuff.
Yeah, so. Like Iron Man.
He's a good storyteller, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like Chef was, I mean, I think it's one of his best movies.
I liked Chef. I did like Chef, but you know what? There was a little bit of something that frustrated me, and this is very personal about it, because I have kids, right?
Sure.
And I have kids that are probably, my daughter is 9. She could if he had taken down some of the cursing, I could have watched that with my kid.
Gotcha.
And it's not that I'm all for pushing an R-rated movie, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, there's an opportunity miss where this is about bonding with your kid. And I love that idea. Yeah. It's like,
I can't do
it with my daughter yet.
So I have a 5-month-old. I just had my first kid.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
In the middle of making this movie.
Wow.
It was kind of crazy. But so I haven't hit that stage yet where she's still not really a person yet.
Yep.
I should be taken care of. And that's I can totally see that, though. It's a good point. Yeah.
Wow.
But I love the kind of like, you know, it was obviously kind of a metaphor for his experience making Iron Man and all those Iron Man movies. You know, there's a lot of truth in there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep. Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. All right. So I've got a couple of questions for you.
Cool.
First of all, Luis should talk about how you ended up coming on this podcast, right?
Yeah. Totally.
Because what happened was, basically, I was just following our Twitter feed, and I said, oh my God, I just found this podcast from, you know, Chaos Group Labs, and it's like really cool, all these old familiar names. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute, that's Wes Ball. How did he find us? And I was like, and I'll be honest, I don't know much about you at all. Okay.
We'll get to the bottom of that today.
which is cool. But I was like, wow, it's like, that's the guy who directed Maze Runner. Now, the reason that I don't know much about you and your CG world, because there is actually, some people may not know this, especially in the early days of CG, there's a little bit of a division
between
the Lightwave people.
Exactly, totally.
Lightwave people and
everyone
and
else.
Maya and Max people.
That's always what I loved about Lightwave, too, is that we were always like the underdogs.
Yeah,
you know?
And they love Lightwave people. To refer to themselves as the underdogs.
To this day, Lightwave people are generally in general, generalists.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Which is something I'm really proud of in my day, you know?
But I really think that if the Lightwave people had joined forces with the Max people, who were also generalists,
totally.
They could have completely broken down and defeated the
Mayan
people.
I still question what's going to happen there. But I still, to this day, I love Lightwave's camera transport kind of the way it works, the way it functions.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy animating my cameras in Lightwave more than any other program.
Because
it's just very intuitive to me, and I can just feel it and just create some very natural, real camera moves. Whereas, you know, other programs, you know, I've become more of a Modo guy lately because I love its renderer, which is basically based on the Lightwave renderer.
Yep.
Same guys, obviously. There's just something about, I still sometimes go back into Lightwave to do some animation and then bake it out to FBX over to
Modo. Well, we should hook you up with a version of, you know, the V-Ray from Modo is out in beta right now.
Really? Sweet. See, that's the thing. V-Ray was always the thing for me. I was always jealous, you know, when I was in the Lightwave days, you know, and like the renderers coming out with the V-Ray.
The Modo render is really good. So
I love it.
You know,
I rendered all of my short Ruin. It was all done in Modo.
All right. Well, we're going to get to the bottom of Ruin because I think that's really kind of one of those things that.
That was the big one that kind of got me started.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lightwave guys, and what got you into lighting. Okay, so I did do some research.
Okay, cool. And I was like, it's always different, though, when I hear these stories get out, like they might be wrong, so we'll correct them.
Exactly. So you got your BFA from Florida State University.
Yeah, I went to film school there. Yeah.
You went to film school there. Yeah. Right. And I did watch your thesis project, which is
my first animation attempt.
Yes, 2002.
2002, right? It was done on Lightwave.
It's on Lightwave.
I used Sasquatch or whatever for Whirly Labs, you know, their fur tool. First time ever. Really? And that's what I've always done, too, is when I find these projects, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yep.
But I love, like, just finding the tools and figuring it out. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's very much that. We're a live-action school, so I learned on film, which we had the last class, I think, that actually shot film, edited film, all that stuff. And when I went into film school, I wanted to be in posts, I thought. I thought I wanted to be an editor. And then I made this one short, basically a silent film ripoff of The Matrix.
Uh-huh.
Basically using an old World War II, Bolex camera, wind-up camera. And we did this ridiculous short editing camera. You know, it was just really ambitious and crazy and kind of stood out from what everyone else had done. And that was my first time that we showed it in the room with all of our class. We all showed our films, our little 2.5-minute films.
Right.
And I got this huge response from my classmates. It was just people cheering and laughing and having such a good time with it. And that was the moment where I got my bug that I wanted to tell stories and be a director.
You right.
know what I mean? And so for the last, you know, for those next 2-3 years at film school, I was learning, you know, just traditional live action filmmaking stuff.
Sure.
And then I've always loved animation. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of found my way into Lightwave, which I started early on in high school on the video toaster.
Right.
And I just decided on a whim one day, I know what I'm going to do. It's like right around the time when Pixar was doing their thing in a big way, you know. And I was like, I'm going to do the school's first animation, you know, short coming out of this live action school. And it was ridiculous. It was totally ambitious, and I shouldn't have.
And you did most of it yourself, or
all
of it.
Myself,
all
of
it, yeah,
all of it.
And so the animation, the stories, the modeling, the texturing,
everything. It was fun. I mean, like I said, it was just a challenge. We just kind of bit off. So what was crazy is that, you know, it was our thesis film. So it was the time when, you know, theoretically we were supposed to have whatever we wanted. We could use the crane. We could use the Steadicam. It was like we were the graduating class. You have all the toys. Yeah. And I didn't have that at all in that one. You know, it's like I just started focused on basically a simple little story. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to do something because in film school, a lot of the shorts you see are, you know, a serial killer or some really kind of dramatic thing about someone, you know, dealing with the loss of a, you know, whatever, something really dramatic and serious.
Yep.
And I wanted to do something that was totally different than everyone else. It was going to be very kind of sweet, very Disney, and kind of made it for my little nephew, basically.
Yeah.
And I figured it was going to stick out that way, you know, and as long as I could kind of focus on telling a good story. And so I basically ended up just having an old SR3, asked for an old SR3 camera, 16mm, Super 16, a couple lenses, and I had a reflector board. Didn't have any lights.
Right.
And so I was like this bare minimum little film shoot we shot for a day with a bunch of kids.
Right.
And if anyone hasn't seen the short, you can watch it on YouTube.
Yep.
But it's kind of this little parallel stories of this little girl kind of on a playground who's kind of alone, and she kind of dives into her sketchbook to kind of, escape her reality. And that's kind of how these dual stories about these characters finding friends, basically. And I use the animation side to kind of go into her kind of sketchbook, and it worked out.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah,
it's a good story.
I got a student Oscar off of that. So that's basically how, right as I graduated, I came out here, and kind of the Hollywood doors opened up right off that short, basically.
That's awesome.
But I rebelled against it because I said, I'm never going to do another animation, you know, Disney thing ever again, you know. And it was a great little project to be a part of, and I learned a lot from it, you know.
Well, that's it. You know, the thing is, you never really know what you're going to get known for, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, I mean, it was weird. Like, I'm sitting here, and you know, I was thinking, I'm going to, you know, long ago, I would have said, my goal would be to really sort of focus on being a VFX supervisor on something.
Yeah.
Well, today I was in a restaurant. Some guy said, "Wait a minute."
Oh yeah,
I recognized your laugh. It's like they says, "Are you the guy who does the CG Crush podcast?"
Oh, really? That's awesome. That's funny. It is so true, though. It's like, you know, especially coming here the first time today, I know what you look like. You know, all I have is this picture in my head of this voice. You know, it is a funny thing, you know? It is odd.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Yeah. So,
you know, along that side, too, is like, you know, someone gave me the most valuable advice out of film school.
Really?
And they said, you're going to have 10 failures before your first success.
Yep.
So get through those first 10 failures as fast as possible.
That's a good idea. Know? Yeah.
And that's the way I kind of approached it when I got out of film school.
Yeah, just make.
And it was years before I finally made that short ruin that kind of launched everything.
You know, it's interesting. It happened to me this weekend. I went to my daughter. Like I said, my daughter is 9 years old. And I said, what do you want to... I said, I want to do something with you now that you're older, that we have a longer term project that we can, like father-daughter project to work together. You know, what do you want to do? And my idea is like, I wanted to build a computer with her to teach her how to use a computer.
Sure.
And
how it works.
Without even hesitating, she looks at me and says, I want to make a movie.
Oh, really? Yeah. Right.
I said, okay. All right. There's a lot of work involved, and you're going to get bored really quickly with all the steps. So I got to think of ways to
keep it
interesting. So I think I have to make each project like really start really small, and then build up on it. So
honestly,
she knows
know
more
how
steps.
How you would start. Really, you have to start with a story first.
Well, you're right. I do have to start with a story. Always have to start with a story. Yeah. But she has a joke book that she always reads.
That's cool.
I figured, why not take one of the jokes and like. Just act it out.
That'd be great.
It's all written for you already. Totally. We already know it's supposed to be, and act it out, and then that would be the first thing we do.
Yeah, comedy's always work as shorts too.
Yes. Comedy's always good. What was one of the things I learned? Bill Plimpton, you know who Bill Plimpton is, the animator, right?
Yeah.
So he does a lecture, and he talks about how when you're doing a short and you're trying to sell your shorts, it says try to make them short, first of all.
Yeah.
Don't make them too
long.
That's
what I always tell people.
Yeah, really short. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll make it really short, like 10 minutes. Like, that's way too long.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like 3 minutes
or less.
Yeah. You know, one make
if
them.
If you're really ambitious, 7.
Yeah.
That's it.
Make them usually without dialogue.
Especially today on YouTube.
Yes. Without dialogue.
Yeah.
Because that can sell more, get more views because people don't have to understand what you're saying, and more international
plus it
views.
Forces you to be more creative visually.
Yep.
You know, we don't have to rely on dialogue.
Yeah, and he says, and if you really want to sell something, just make it funny, because make it funny always like, oh, you got to see this
works.
Thing, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, do you see this thing, it's really pretty.
Yeah.
It's, it works, but not as much as
it
was funny.
Pay off is all you really need mechanically, you know. And unfortunately, with horror and all that stuff, you have to do a lot of build up for, you know, it's just all those different genres that you need more time, you know, to do that stuff.
But horror is fun. Like, if you want to do something fun,
I
think people who make horror films have more fun than people watching them.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing that I couldn't figure out in this whole thing. So 2002, that happened.
Yeah.
In 2011, ruin happened.
Yeah.
So what happened between 2002 and 2011?
Yeah, so basically 2003 was when I came out here after film. So film school is, you know, the short was made right at the end of 2002. So I came out here right then. And like I said, basically I won a Student Academy Award off of that short, A Work in Progress.
Yep.
And so immediately the agents and the managers and all that stuff happened because they saw it and said, oh, cool, you know how to do this stuff.
Great.
And so I was like, great, sounds good. They start, you know, you do the bottled water tour of Los Angeles, you go and meet all these executives and say, you know, I'm this 22-year-old kid, what do you want to do? I want to be a director, I want to do this. What kind of stories you got? Oh, I don't know. And I was like, all right, come back to us kind of thing. So pretty quickly, actually, a couple months after, I had this idea for a movie. It was called The Treehouse, and it was this little dark kid's fantasy. Very similar to sort of Coraline or Clive Barker's Thief of Always.
Yep.
It was kind of about this idea of this kid wanting to kind of, you know, not appreciating his home life and being kind of lured away by this sort of supernatural force, kind of taking you into a fantasy world, and then ultimately finding out this beautiful paradise is your prison. And then he finds – it was actually a cool little story. And what I found later is that I actually stole a ton of ideas out of that thing for some of my other movies. But and so I came up with this idea, and I pitched it all around town, and I actually ended up selling it to Warner Brothers.
Great.
So that was my first little kind of sell to into the Hollywood world, and that was probably around 2004 or something like that. And so quickly I figured out what development hell was.
Yeah.
So that was about a year and a half of working on this thing and just watching it just kind of unravel before my eyes. And I was a really young kid, and I had all these producers and all these big shot Hollywood people around, and I didn't know the job of the director to how important it is to steer the ship and to keep things right. And what would happen is, you know, this thing would just kind of, you know, very quickly unravel and become something else. It started from this really cool dark fantasy movie, became like a Lord of the Rings epic, and then it became like this, you know, teen horror thing. It just kind of dismantled, basically, you know?
Yeah.
And so that kind of just faded away, and then I went away and licked my wounds, and I was like, what am I going to do here? And it was right around the exact same time that was happening.
Could you count that as one of your failures?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And I learned more
out
of that.
You learned a lot. Development hell, I think a lot of people don't realize. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, you showed something. It's mm-hmm. great, got its attention.
Yeah.
That's only the first step. Oh. Doesn't mean you're going to be making a movie next week.
Absolutely the first step.
No.
And it's the tiniest first step of them all. But yeah, it was interesting because at the same time that was happening, my short had come out, and I was meeting all these other people on the post side of things saying, oh, you know computers and animation. That means you can do this for us, right? And I was like, sure. So I very quickly started getting a lot of freelance work doing animation, you know, DVD titles and all kinds of stuff like that. You know what I mean?
So that's what was paying your bills during that
basically,
time?
Basically, yeah. And the biggest thing that happened is I found a guy who did all the stuff for Mark Burnett, all the reality shows, so it included The Apprentice.
Okay.
And so what a lot of people don't know is about a lot of those shows, reality shows, they're made so quickly and so fast that there's camera people and there's mics and there's all kinds of things that are showing up in the shots.
Right.
And you can't have them in there. And
right.
someone has to paint those out.
Really?
So I became the guy. They used to have a big company that would do all that stuff for them. And this guy basically said, hey, you know how to do computers. You know how to do this stuff yourself, right? And of course I didn't.
Right.
But naively I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. And so I quickly became the only person that did all of The Apprentice's work for paint out stuff.
Wow.
And it was an incredible training ground. Actually paid really well.
Yeah.
So I could, afford things. And I would be responsible for fixing Trump's hair and changing his tie color and changing continuity issues and removing crew members from the shots and taking out all kinds of things like that. And I was just learning it as I went, basically, And I became really good at this kind of paint and roto stuff. And I did it for years and paid the bills that way. And I kind of ended up basically starting my little company, Oddball Animation, doing that
right.
stuff. It was basically a freelance company, where a lot of our friends
were. So was that yours or
yeah,
you had a couple people working?
It was mine. And then, I would have a few friends that were also knowing this stuff and doing their own thing too.
Right.
So we'd all just kind of join forces and do work and try to get money out of it.
Right.
And so I did that for a few years. And part of that was during the whole Treehouse thing. And then part of it was after that. I kind of went away and licked my wounds and okay, I'm just going to focus on this for a while I kind of figure out what I'm going to do. And so then I got to a point where I was like, I just have to make something for myself. This is crazy.
Sure.
And that's when I decided I was going to do that short Ruin.
Right.
And I made that. And that was, I don't know when that was.
But 2008? From what I saw, okay, I spoke to David Tracy. Do you remember David Tracy?
Yeah.
Okay. So David was, he works for us now. He's our communications director.
Oh, cool.
But he used to work for Luxology back in the day.
Right.
All new tech and stuff. So, but anyway, he was telling me that he says hi, by the way.
Hello. I like David. He's cool.
Yeah. He said that you may have been working on Ruin for 4 years?
So here's how the Ruin thing happened. Basically was, I had been thinking about Ruin as a movie.
As a
concept.
Movie. Yep.
Right. For a long time. And I had collected all kinds of artwork and just done my own stuff and all this great stuff and created something really, really big and epic.
Mm-hmm.
Really big. I was going to take it out and try to sell it, So I would kind of be dabbling with that along with some other projects too, which I've also now kind of what's funny is now I have all this ability now to actually get things set up now. I can go back to these old projects.
Sure.
But Ruin was, a thing that I was playing around with as a movie concept for years. And honestly, what happened was I came out of Avatar blown away.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to do something like that. Uh-huh. I can do that. Digital, fully CG, but made like a live action movie.
Right.
And I was like, I can do that. And I can use Ruin to do that, to take that kind
of thing. So that was the thing. It's like, I'm going to take that and...
Basically, yeah. Run. So basically what I looked at, I was like, what I can do here is kind of the open to Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it was basically an introduction to a character in a world. It's not so much story, but it gives you a little taste of a much larger thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't a pitch tool, wasn't anything. I kind of want to stress that. I didn't go out this to try to go sell it. It was purely this was going to be my last thing. I was going to go work for ILM or Weta or something else.
Right.
In fact, I was actually going to go work for Bad Robot right before I got the job to do The Maze Runner.
Okay.
And so basically, I looked at this little thing I've been working on forever, Ruin. And I was like, you know what? I could do this. It's actually the opening scene was always going to be this idea of a guy on a bike. It's kind of cool chasing through this crazy world.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's kind of like the Star Wars Trench Run. It's kind of contained.
Yeah.
I don't have to create a giant world. It's kind of this walls on the side. It became much bigger,
right.
When I started working on it. But when I decided I was going to do it, it basically was for about 8 months is when I started doing it.
Okay.
So I said, okay, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to shut down my doors for hopefully 5 months is what, mm-hmm. what the goal was. I'm going to use whatever I have in the savings. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to focus on making this only. And it'll be, if nothing else, a good show reel so I can go get a job at, you know, one of the big houses or something.
Right.
And so the actual short itself was not like a 4-year process, but the sort of inception of the ideas
sure.
in the world and things that actually do show up in the short
yep.
were part of that 4 years of just brainstorming and thinking up the larger story. So the actual production part of it was, you know, I think it was around 7.5 months, something like that.
But it was it. That's all you did.
Yeah, that was it. So that was the risk. You know, that mm-hmm. was basically the swing for the fences. You know, I have to do something one last time before, you know, my wife wanted us. I was, by that point, I think I was married. You know, new kids were coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like my life was about to change and I right. needed to just kind of do this one last thing for myself.
Right.
And then I'll go, you know, get a proper job somewhere. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, yeah, that's where how it started. And then, you know, I was going to do this thing as a, you know, I was going to do it stereoscopic. So I did it that way too. And that kind of wow. added 3 months to the process.
Wow.
But it was back to
that's
that.
Because of the Avatar thing, right?
It was. And I was like, man, it blew my mind just the level of density and that stuff, you know?
Right.
And so I started doing these tests really quickly on really early on, and that's when I found Modo with its instancing
mm-hmm.
and it's using its replicators
yep.
and how, you know, I was, how am I going to create this kind of overgrown look, you know what I mean?
Right.
And what I found was I found all this freedom in just doing it for real with real geometry,
yep,
you know, and not sort of painting it, not doing any cheats,
right.
but just rely on density, you know?
Yep.
And so I used a render service online.
Oh, really?
To render everything. I would send it off at night and it would come back in the morning.
So
what
was the render service? Do you remember?
It was called RebusFarm.net.
Rebus, yeah.
And it was fantastic. It had a little script for Modo,
mm-hmm.
and it worked. So what I would do is I'd build all my assets, and I hired one guy, a modeler, to model the character for me because I wasn't a very good modeler, and he modeled the little drone ship for me.
Sure.
And then so I got those back, and then I was responsible for texturing, animating, lighting, and rendering ultimately. And I'm better at the camera and lighting and rendering than mm-hmm. I am at the other stuff, but
sure.
you know, I made it work.
Yeah, modeling, so, especially complex stuff, modeling yeah. is a different skill.
And this is my first attempt at a CG human, which wasn't totally successful, but you know, it worked out. It did its job. But you know, I knew it was really ambitious, and that's kind of
did
the
you
fun
do
of
the
it.
Animation too?
Yeah, did all the animation, and I had a an animation intern. His name was Adam. He emailed me because he saw some of the tests that I was doing
yep.
online, and he's like, "Hey, can I come in and help? You know, and I can call it an internship for his he was at the Ringling, I think.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, "Yeah, you can come in." So for 3 weeks, he came in, and he and I in my little like office, I shared an office with a couple guys, kind of much like your office here.
Yeah,
And we just kind of played for a couple of weeks, and he animated 3 of the shots of the guy kind of sliding down and jumping over, and
right.
and then I would just basically be responsible for everything else. And you know, the credits on that thing is mainly my sound work, which I got some great friends to do. And these guys at Snap Sound, Zach Sievers and Justin Davies, they did some really kick-ass work for
yeah.
So as a, you know, because they wanted
sounds important.
Yeah. Oh, it's everything. It's yeah. more than 50% of the experience.
Yeah. And when we were doing IRL a long time ago, and I think I've said this story before, but the idea was that we didn't have really any money or figuring out yeah. what we were going to do. We wanted to save as much money as possible.
Right.
And the guy, I asked a guy who's done a bunch of shorts, and he says, if you have any money at all,
right.
put it into sound.
Yeah.
Because you can fix bad picture.
Yeah,
you can't
that's
fix
right.
bad sound.
Not only that, but it turns you off immediately when it's
yeah.
bad sound, bad recorded sound even, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. So ultimately in the end, the ruined thing, it cost me about in cash,
yeah.
like 10 grand.
Really?
That was
all including the rendering?
That was the rendering. That was the rendering. And so, everything else was my time, which is not free either.
What were your render times then?
Oh, it was crazy. I'm telling you, I was rendering shots that were 5-6 billion polygons, you know, and
right.
they were, and because of my style, you know, if you look at that short, it's about 8 minutes long, a little too long. Actually, I look back on it now and I'm like, I should have trimmed this down a little bit. But anyway, 8 minutes long and it was only 80 shots.
Right.
So it gives you an average of what the shot length is.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's actually pretty long shots in those things. Some of those shots in there, it was almost a minute long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of my style. I like that. I like kind of telling a story through the camera
right.
rather than relying on editing. And so that made things a little bit easier because it means I was working on one long shot rather than 5 little ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes things actually easier.
Yep.
But yeah, those render times were significant, and because I was rendering it twice,
left and right eye.
You know, it was.
I'm still amazed, and this is the thing that people are like, "Oh no, you know, can't afford a render farm. You know, can't afford to outsource rendering."
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, no, I was impressed.
$10,000, and you rendered stereo 8 minutes of HD footage.
And at 2K.
At 2K, so.
It was cool. And, you know, I cranked up all the settings. And, you know, of course, sometimes the worst is when you had those errors.
Right,
yeah. You know, and so I would go through a lot of work to try to make sure that everything is right.
Because,
you know, wasting that money was the worst feeling ever.
Yep.
But yeah, it worked out, man, and it was cool. It was a fun process. It was totally worth it. And like I said, even if nothing had happened out of it, I would have been happy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just, I had a fun time with it, and I got to kind of show what I could do, you know, without anyone telling me.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
So one thing I saw, and we were trying to figure out where it came from, but you mentioned it, someone said that they saw a frame or a shot from Ruined in a J.J. Abrams thing.
Yeah, so there's a cool story there, basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously I'd been making that short, and I was kind of slowly slipping it out, especially on the Moto forums and the Lightweight forums, what I was kind of, you know, playing around with and getting close to finishing. And it was right around that point when I was like, guys, I'm going to be done with this in about a month.
Right.
And so I put up a bunch of stills of where it was going. And then I get a call from JJ.
Yeah.
Saying, dude, I saw your stuff. Looks pretty cool. Come on in. Let's talk.
Okay.
And so he's actually a closet Moto guy.
Yes, I know that, actually.
You know, and he's like, you know, can you show me how to do some of this stuff? And so I put together...
He did the logo for Lost.
Yeah, I know. In Lightwave, I think, actually.
In Lightwave.
Yeah. Which I can see all the errors in it, too, which is
funny. So I don't know if you... There's a little side story on that, because he did this thing, and there's errors in it. And to people like us,
it's
frustrating, right? So many people redid exactly the shot and fixed the errors and submitted to him like in
like,
full
nope.
quality. He was like, please just
funny.
Use this. And he's like, nope.
I know, it's funny. It's really funny. In fact, I did my title on the last movie, on the original, the first one. I did that title.
Oh, really?
In Moto, actually.
Wow, there you go.
Actually, I did a couple shots in the last one, too. But yeah, so I kind of started having a relationship with the guys that were Bad Robot.
Right.
And it was funny. I went to like the set of Star Trek, you know. And
wow.
And it was just cool. Like, whoa, J.J. Abrams, how you doing, man? He's like, hey, dude, hey, let's do something. Yeah, it's like, cool. Because they're very similar. Like, have you ever been to their place?
Yes, I have, actually.
It's fantastic. It's this little, like, workshop of just, like, fun.
It's a toy store.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's cool. And they have, like, a screen printer over there and a 3D printer over here. And it's just, they just kind of have fun making stuff. And, you know, you can only afford that when you have the deal they have at Paramount. You know, it pays for everything.
Right.
But yeah, so I really kind of get in a relationship with those guys. And it was right around that time after Ruin came out. I put it out online and it kind of went crazy, and then boom, you know, it went viral like immediately, basically.
Sure.
And so what happened is essentially all of the studio doors opened up again. And so I got another crack at that whole bottled water tour of Los Angeles.
Yep.
You know? And this time I was a little bit smarter and a little bit wiser. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And fortunately, all those years of work I had done on Ruin, suddenly now I had a short. And instead of saying, yeah, I wanted to make movies, it's now it's like, oh, I have a gigantic movie that's attached to this short that you like so much.
But the thing that's important about that short is that there are a lot of people who make some shorts, right? And they'll like, oh, great, we'll make it a movie, right? But it doesn't always translate.
No,
I mean, an example is like the short for Pixels did not necessarily translate into the movie Pixels, right? Because very different, but I can see where one came from the other and it was good. But yours is like, there's something that just happened.
Yeah.
I want to know what happened before that. I want to know what happens after that.
Well, the way I made it basically was it was as if it was the first scene of a larger movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? It had a beginning, middle, and end, but all sequences do in a movie. All scenes in a movie do. So it wasn't like it was a little perfectly self-contained short.
Sure.
It was a little piece of a much larger story.
Right.
It was a little sliver. And the thing is, what was great about it is I could slip in all these little like things that I knew no one would ever even understand, but like when I went into a room and suddenly I talked about, well, you know that thing on his hand or that thing he's looking for or whatever it is.
Right, the nanotechnology thing.
Exactly. There's all these little almost Easter eggs essentially from a much larger mythology. And it actually is a very big thing. You know, Ruin is basically my Star Wars. It's a big, big, cool project that I hope we'll see the light of day sometime soon. But so what happened, though, is you know, that kind of opened up the door really quickly, met with a lot of fantastic people, including, you know, Bad Robot and all those guys. They want to be involved. And, you know, and they this is all kind of in the span of about a month or so. It was crazy. And so they were just working on Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know what? We got this trailer. We're trying to cut this stuff together, and we used one of your shots in Ruin. And I was like, can we use it? I'm like, are you serious?
What?
I was like,
how did I get the, they just grabbed it to, yeah, as a temp shot?
Yeah, exactly. It's as a temp shot.
Oh,
and then I was like, why would you want to use it? It's full CG. It's not ready. It's not ready for prime time. Why would you want to do that? And they're like, oh, it's good enough. It's fine with me. I'm like, fine, whatever. So they paid me a little money, and they licensed it from me.
Wow.
To put it in the short there, in the Revolution short. So that was that little story. And so meanwhile, all this craziness was happening around the studios. And I had met with the guys at Fox, and this one guy in particular, Steve Asbell, who was a really, really great executive there at Fox. And I was telling him about this larger story I had planned. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna pitch it to you really soon. I had a screenwriter friend, T.S. Nolan, who's I went to school with, and he had already become kind of a Hollywood screenwriter by that point.
That's awesome.
He's writing, you know, specs and all this stuff for Hollywood.
Right.
And so, you know, he and I kind of teamed up and started figuring out what we would do to kind of pitch this thing and sell it. And so I told him, yeah, it's coming. It's just, we keep talking about this Ruin thing, and like, it's coming, a few more weeks, I'm going to come in and pitch you this story. And then, you know, at the same time, I was telling them how I made this thing, stereoscopic 3D, and, you know, I had a full 5.1 mix from my friends over at Snap Sound, and I had never heard of it before because, you know, I'm doing stereoscopic with red and blue glasses on my computer. Right. I had never really seen it properly.
Yeah.
I'm like, well,
wow.
Dude,
right.
You got to bring it in. We'll put it up on one of our theaters, and we'll also, like, make a thing out of it.
Right.
I was like, oh, cool. That'd be great. So it was a little fun little thing, and they invited a couple of producers over and just kind of watched this thing. And so we screened it like a couple weeks after it came out, and we watched it and things. Oh, that was great. That was fantastic. Wow, it was really cool. Like, I hadn't seen it in 3D before. That's really great. And then it was after that meeting, as we were all leaving, another executive came up to me, and they handed me this book called Maze Runner and said, go take this home and read it. Tell me what you think. And I said, okay. So I took it home and read it, and I thought about it for a few weeks and for a week or two, and I let my wife read it, and she actually kind of liked it, which told me something.
Mm-hmm.
And I started finding my way into this thing, and I very quickly kind of started to see sequences, exactly how they could be shot, and that tells me a lot now. At the time, I didn't know. I wasn't sure. I was like, should I do this? Oh my God, this could be a great opportunity. I don't know. So what I did was I took all the assets that I did from Ruin. I came up with some really cool systems for creating overgrowth and concrete textures and all this great stuff. And so basically that was the world of Maze Runner, which is concrete walls overgrown by whatever.
The you can totally see Ruin.
Yeah, like, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which it wasn't intentional or anything, but I guess that's what they saw too. So I had made about 5 or 6 really cool images for what I saw the movie could be. And so about a week or two later, I came in and I pitched the head of the studio. His name's Emma Watts. We've since now become, you know, really great friends. And you know, when you're going in to meet the head of the studio, it's like there's all this kind of, you know, everyone's going, oh my God, you got to be quick. You have to be really fast. She's got 10 minutes. She's got, you know, a million movies going on, all this stuff. You have to be fast and get out of there and quick. And don't screw up, Wes. Don't screw this up.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. So we go in and start talking, and it went great. We talked for like an hour, and it was like just the smoothest thing ever. Yep. And at the end of that meeting, it was, great, you're our director. Let's do this. And so I get up and walk out. Oh my God, I think I just got a movie, finally. And so I walk out of that meeting and everything's cool. And that was a Monday. And so on a Tuesday rolls around that morning, and I get a call saying, hey, look, they do want you to make this movie. They think it's going to be a good job. You're going to do a good job with it. But they're going to put a pin in it just for a moment because we see you coming in to finally pitch Ruin tomorrow.
Oh my God.
So here I have that hanging over my head.
So you're going in the next day to put on hold what could be a major measure.
And so I came in on that Wednesday, and we pitched Ruin. Me and TS, my buddy, pitched Ruin, and we sold that in the room. It was a really great pitch. I mean, it's really good. It's a cool story.
So they bought Ruin, and it's just been waiting till you
just
have time to do it.
Waiting for me to have time to do it. And so that was the goal. So basically, that was a whirlwind of a week, man. That was like by the end of Wednesday, I had basically two movies of Fox. And you know, the thing was, they wanted to get started on Maze Runner fast,
right?
And this is kind of the internal politics of kind of, you know, the studio things. Like, you know, Steve Asbell is my executive on Ruin, and I had another executive that was on Maze Runner. So they have, you know, they're not in sync. You know what I mean?
Right.
So one person, it was a little bit of like what are you gonna do first? And then Emma was like, no, we're making Maze Runner.
Right.
You know, the studio said that. So you know, within like 3 or 4 months, you know, we scrapped the script, started over, got the thing working, and then we were off shooting. And
wow.
The goal was going to be, I'm going to do this one movie, and hopefully it works out and works great, and then I can go make Ruin.
Right.
And
well,
then
you still got two more to do.
Right. And then, you know, I got kind of like tied up in this whole franchise thing.
Right.
But it's still, you know, it's still being worked on, and it still is that passion project of mine. And along with a couple other things that are
well, it's interesting because Maze Runner is for some from Vlado, who's the V in V-Ray.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
he's an awesome guy. Yeah. I've known him for years and years, and he loves Maze Runner.
Oh yeah,
loves
that's
that
cool.
movie.
That's great.
And when he saw it, he just and he's a very quiet, demure guy, and he says, he didn't even know that a lot of it was rendered in V-Ray.
I was like, oh, I didn't.
And so
he really, Method
at the time. So it was really
cool. Great. And it was fun too, man. It was a great experience. And it was a really small movie. It's like a little $34 million movie.
Yeah, but it's really well done. You know, I think sometimes, you know, first time directors, right?
Yeah.
They're going to give you a movie like this. What they do is that
they took a huge chance on me.
They did take a huge chance. They always take huge chances on guys. But you know what? I've seen a lot of success if you keep the budget small, right?
Yeah.
And it's
right.
funny to say $34 million a small movie, but for something like that,
in studio terms, that's really small. Because
right. It could have easily been a $150 million, $200 million movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll see what happens in the next one, too. And we stepped it up even further.
But just keeping that way, and it
forces you to focus. And those kind of limitations, I always talk about it. And those limitations are good for you. Creative limitations are great.
Yeah.
Because it means you come up with some really creative solutions. And I think, if nothing else, a director's job. Anyway, at the very end of everything, you have to be an awesome problem solver.
Yes.
Because you have so many problems coming to you every single second.
Right.
Whether it's the sound or the actors or the location or the shot or whatever it is, you have to be a really good problem solver. And that's part of the fun of putting together a movie with all these different sort of mediums. I mean, it's the only medium that really has – it brings in music, photography, and sound, you know, and those kinds of – all these different art forms basically. To come up with a kind of a cohesive sort of experience. You know, it's the only kind of thing, besides video games perhaps.
Right.
And so the amount of problems you deal with on every day is just, it's absolutely insane.
Oh, yeah. It's all you do is answer
but
problems.
But that's also kind of why I always like the VFX side of things, because you're solving these problems. You're trying
all
to figure out, I'm taking all these tools, and how do I create the one shot in Ruin is like a 5-6 billion poly shot. How am I going to pull that off? You know,
right.
Like just the little tricks you come up with, and because it was just me. I wasn't hand painting those worlds. I kind of came up with little procedural tricks to create that kind of overgrowth using just basically modular elements and stuff. And I'm really proud of a lot of the stuff I did on Ruin and a lot of little kind of things I came up with. At the time, I could look back on that and say that's the best I could do at that moment. That was the peak of what I knew how to do. You know what I mean?
Yep. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, it's a good feeling, you know, when you do that.
It is. And I always kind of joke about this. I guess people don't really believe me, but I always say that one of my favorite times, I used to be a VFX soup for commercials, and one of my favorite times is actually the bidding process, which most people hate. Right?
Yeah, sure.
But my favorite thing about it is usually some director comes up who may not necessarily be a VFX person, right? Will come up and I was like, I want to do this. And they spew out this way over-ambitious thing.
Sure.
And their budget is like nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And so what a lot of people say, well, it'll cost you this much. It's like, well, you're way too expensive. We'll go somewhere else. But they're not – the VFX house or the VFX supervisor is not taking the opportunity, because what you can do is like, okay.
How would we do this?
Right. What do you want to do? And then sometimes you come up with way better ideas.
Right, exactly.
In the end, you're like, your ideas, just the fact that you're
having – those kind of forces that push you into new territory is what's important for the creative process.
Yeah.
And that's actually something that I have to be careful about, because I actually know fairly a lot about CG stuff.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
It's both, honestly. I think – and in some ways, it's a very good thing, because I can at least, if nothing else, talk about really quickly, or I can put together some of my mock-ups were, you know, they really take my camera and my models and just build on top of it, you know, and just build on top of the shot. But sometimes it limits me, because I'm like, man, I don't know how we're going to do this. You know, so it's like, I won't even ask for it. You know what I mean?
You can't think of a solution.
Exactly,
you didn't give the opportunity to someone else.
Exactly. So I have to be careful with that sometimes myself. I didn't do this much on this last one, the Scorch Trials, but it's something I have to be careful about. It's like, you know, we're working with some very smart people. My job now is to be the dreamer and try to be ambitious and just know where to spend the money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember it was interesting, because, you know, I've worked on a couple of Joe Kaczynski films.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a VFX guy.
Sure,
too,
totally. I wonder what that's like, yeah.
And so he was, you know, it's the what I always joke about is like the only director I've known who asked me what my noise threshold was on a shot. So.
Right, yeah, totally, right. That's funny.
But he does try to think of solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, I think he does put a lot of trust into the system. You have to. You can't.
Well, at some point, especially at his level, because he's starting to do all his commercials before he got into the Tron.
Right.
I mean, I find it happening to myself now, so I'm not getting on the box very often anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, even myself.
That's why I try to stay on the podcast and all these things, and try to stay up to what are the new tools coming out, you know, because I want to know what's going on and how to use those things to kind of tell cool stories, you know. And at the same time, my big thing with movies, and I tell the studio this, and of course they love hearing it, is I want to do more for less. I want movies to come down in price. I think it's just gotten absolutely crazy. And I don't want that $120 million burden on my back.
Amen to that.
It's absolutely crazy. And I think we can be more efficient. We can be more creative. And, you know, and
focus on story again.
And focus on story and let the spectacle serve that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I always talk about kind of empty calories, these movies that it's Big Bang and all this great stuff that's happening. But I go out of that theater and I've forgotten the movie.
Right.
There's nothing there anymore. So it's like, you know, we're trying on our side with what we're doing at the studio is to try to bring back some of those, you know, smaller stories on a larger canvas.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So we'll see how that works for us. We're not the $100 million movies, but we're trying to look as close to them as we can, I guess.
Yeah, you know? No, that's good. Yeah. Absolutely. I loved it. I loved Maze Runner. I thought it was really cool. I thought it was very well done, very well shot. I thought it looked really great. I saw the story. I bonded to the characters.
Yeah.
It was a good development, and it made sense. And I think those types of films are the ones that need to be made more often.
Yeah.
Now, because you have a CG background, right, and you've known what we've been doing, obviously you've been doing a lot of it, there's been a backlash recently in terms of CG.
Tell me about it, man.
Okay.
I get pissed by it, actually.
By that backlash, right?
Yeah, I think people don't know what they're talking about.
Of course they don't know what they're talking about.
You know, I mean, if we were to use those old tools today, you'd laugh at it now.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. I mean, a lot of movies, they think they have no CG in it. They don't realize that you're seeing CG. You know, you're seeing just good CG. They see the bad stuff and say, oh, CG's bad.
Because when good CG is good, you don't know it's there. And when bad CG is bad, then it's there.
And all that, but everyone always does that thing. Like, go back to the real stuff. I guarantee you, everyone who says, I'm using all the old school tricks, no. They're going back in. They're practically probably replacing all the miniature work, all the prosthetic work or miniature stuff.
Yeah.
I've seen it happen. I mean, I just said it myself in this last movie we did. I'm going to do a lot of makeup effects this time. You know, I'm not going to do anything else. The makeup stuff doesn't look very good.
No.
You know, it's like you have to go back in and
well, yeah.
The clarity of today's images now, you can't get away with that stuff anymore. You need the subtlety and the kind of sophistication of what CG gives you or visual effects in today's world gives you. But not that you can't take tricks and, like, you know, base it off of real stuff. But yeah, I agree. It's all about just a tool and it's whose hands it's in.
Right.
Sound can be really terrible too.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's all those things. It's just you have to know how to use it. You know?
And a lot of people like to praise how Mad Max was done all practical, but it's not.
I know.
It's the
biggest one.
It's actually, there's a lot of it that's practical and a lot of it in the same frame as CG.
Right.
What's amazing is you can't tell which part is which is
amazing
CG.
That's what works, right, exactly. And it's also very stylized. But, you know, it's the same thing. It's like I've been thinking about this myself. It's like, you know, I'm obviously a big proponent of the value that visual effects artists and everyone, you know, bring to movies. I think they're underappreciated somewhat. I think it's partly because it is such a magical thing.
Mm-hmm.
People at least see it that way. They think it's probably, oh, it's a computer doing it, not an artist doing it.
Yes.
You know, it's like we must have a magical button that says make human, you know, or something. You know, and maybe it's because our making of videos that we have out there, they're not as fun to watch, maybe, you know, for like the general public, you know, just how you kind of, you know, adjust some curves on an animation curve or adjust some parameters to get that skin looking right.
Yeah.
It's not as fun as watching someone blow up a model. You know what I mean? So it's like people tune out on the process of making visual effects today. But it's an interesting challenge. I think the VFX community is, you know, we've got to figure something out, you know, because we can't have movies without them. It's too, you know, too important of a tool now. But, you know, I feel bad for all these companies that, you know, you see just dropping, you know.
Well, they're struggling, obviously, with the what's going on. And I think that they're, you know, financial side and all the other struggles that they're dealing with aside, there's also a lack of respect that I think that's going on.
Yeah, there is.
And I think that lack of respect is, you know, another thing to do is like, oh, this movie is all CG or whatever, and it's a crappy movie, so the problem is the CG. It's like, have you ever thought about the fact that the story, there's no story?
That's usually the problem.
That's
like, someone told me once, it was
the only reason to see this movie is the CG.
That's the way actually I looked at these last two movies.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's kind of changing now. I think it'll change after this next one comes out. We don't have stars in the movie.
Right.
We don't have stars. The star is the concept in the world.
Right.
You know, it's the visuals.
Right.
And then the characters are just good actors that you hopefully engage with and relate to. And I think we'll see what happens on this next one in a couple of weeks. But that's always been my approach. You know, it's the concept in the world. Could put asses in chairs too. It's interesting stuff. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. So let me see. Some of the other things I came up with. Was an article that I saw, an interview with you on Den of Geeks, talked about some of your inspirations, right? So you said Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned this earlier. Was that something you always enjoyed? I mean...
As a kid?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I grew up on Star Wars.
You grew up on Star Wars.
Grew up, basically, Jurassic Park was probably the most influential movie on me, because it was the first time, it was 93, right?
Yes.
So I was 13 years old. I was right at that perfect time, you know, to kind of start thinking about what I wanted to do.
Right.
I knew I wanted to be involved with movies, and I love special effects. And there was this old show called Movie Magic on Discovery Channel.
Oh,
man, that was everything for me. And that's why I wanted to go into movies. And it was Jurassic Park where I felt like I had everything. It was a great story. It was this new technology, something I'd never seen before.
Yep.
Great score. It was the first score I ever bought. It was kind of the one that really shifted me and kind of, you know, put the goal somewhere for me to point to, you know.
Right.
But you know, T2 was also really important to me, and I know, you know, Abyss was really the big one that kind of got the ball rolling. And
right.
You know, T2 should probably get more credit for starting the whole CG thing.
Well, I think people look at. I mean, that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
T2 was important. Well,
I think people in the community would say T2 and Abyss were probably the important ones, or maybe Sherlock, you know, which was really the first one.
Oh, you should listen to the Scott Ross podcast. Have you listened to that?
I haven't listened to that one.
Yeah, he talked.
Met him actually when I first came out here.
Really?
I went to Digital Domain. And he wanted to meet because he saw my little short.
Right.
And he probably wouldn't even remember me now, but he showed me. He was so nice. He showed me around Digital Domain.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh my God, it's Digital Domain.
Yeah.
And it was, I love going to that place. And I remember we were talking, I was talking about things I wanted to do. And as we were leaving,
wait,
he was like,
what year was this?
This was 2003, probably.
So I was at DD
really?
Working at the time. Yeah. I was working on iRobot, I think.
Oh, that's awesome. I remember he was showing me the stuff that he was doing. They were trying to do their own short with Steve Rossio and Terry. Yeah, okay. So he was showing me some of that stuff and what they were trying to do. I think he was looking for ideas to do.
Right.
I remember him showing me some tests from Benjamin Button.
Uh-huh. Oh, you saw the Benjamin Button test?
Yeah, I saw that.
That was the Lightwave, by the way.
Oh, yeah, nice.
The first test, yes.
But I'll never forget, and this is always a cool little thing, that is after
which
we talked,
I really wished that somehow that would get out, because that test was...
It was cool, man.
I mean, it was shocking at the time how good it was.
I remember, he's like, not allowed to tell anyone about this.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, it was so great because after the meeting was over, he kind of came over and said, hey, I just want you to know, I met a lot of people before. I can tell you're a director. You're going to direct one day.
Yeah. Well,
and I left. And I was like, oh my God, he may be right. Of course, it took 10 years, you know, whatever. But
10 years is pretty good.
Right. But I always remember him for that, you know?
Yeah.
It was cool.
Yeah, anyway, he's really cool. And he talks about, you know, all of his history because he was involved at ILM during the whole Abyss and all that
right,
stuff. So, it's pretty interesting
how that
kind of worked. And the water weenie sequence, as he calls it.
Right. That's funny.
But I loved the, I remember when Jurassic Park came out too, and I'm a little older. I was just going into grad school when that came out, and they had just got all these SGI machines at the university, and they put Wavefront on there. And they used the same software that they did for Jurassic Park. Go at it.
Yeah.
It's like, but no one knows how to use it.
Yeah.
Nope, figure it out.
Yeah, that was my experience in high school, actually. I had this great teacher who bought a video toaster.
Yes.
A video toaster 4000 or whatever. And no one knew anything about it whatsoever.
Right.
And he just put me in a closet and said, there it is. Figure it out. Don't come out until it's working.
Right.
And that was my first exposure to like video and all that stuff. And obviously the little tiny light wave thing that came in it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was kind of starting to learn lens flares and all this crazy stuff. And eventually I remember when Lightwave became its own separate, you know, offshoot or its own little program you could buy. I remember getting him to buy it for me and for the school. And made my first little short that way. It's cool.
Yeah. What was it?
It's important, you know, figuring out yourself, getting your own, you know, knocks. It's cool.
No, I think a lot of people are afraid to, or just, to be honest, I think some people just are too lazy to learn it themselves.
And afraid to fail.
I'm afraid to fail. They're like, well, I don't know how to do this. Yeah. I haven't figured it out, so I just left it alone. It's
totally.
Just keep hammering and hammering and hammering. And that's the same with even movie making, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So cool. So you got wrapped into the franchise of this whole little thing, right?
Yeah, I wasn't planning on it, but, you know, after the first one came out, you know, the studio was feeling pretty good about it because I got my first experience of, you know, testing a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we got really good, you know, really good scores, basically. And they started thinking, you better start thinking about the next one. And basically, I started working on it before the movie came out, and they sent me off to Albuquerque.
Right.
Basically, before the movie even came out. So when the movie came out in September, last September, I was in Albuquerque 4 weeks away from shooting the sequel.
Wow.
And so it happened really fast. So this sequel, this new one that's coming out now in a couple of weeks, we actually finished it. We started shooting in late October. And then we finished it in August. So it was probably, 10 or 11 months that we've turned it around. And it's a significantly bigger movie.
Right.
Really, really much bigger. So it's going to be interesting to see
what happens. Who are the primary VFX is on it?
It was all Weta.
It's all Weta, right?
This time, yeah.
Single and house. So they must have banged that out in, 5 months?
Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh, my God. How many shots?
Actually, what's cool is that we actually had less shots than the first one. It was 591 shots this time.
Oh, okay.
But they're all significantly bigger.
Right.
They're way bigger. But, you know, we focused a little bit more on location work this time. I always love being in real locations.
Sure.
There's something real about that. And then just extending and creating the world around that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Chris White over at Weta and Richard Hollander was my VFX soup on this.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it worked out really well. It was a great, great experience.
Yeah. Well, so obviously you're already probably lined up for the third one, right? Is it a trilogy?
Yeah, it is. So okay. I got to see it through now.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the other project will have to wait, but that's okay. But yeah, it has been fun, and working with the actors and everything, it's just been a great little family unit.
Chris Nolan had to wait a long time before he could make Inception, right?
That's right. That's right. So, I think he didn't he make that in between movies though. Didn't he do something in between Batman?
I guess so.
I think he might have.
Yeah, but
I won't have that luxury here. But yeah, that's okay. I'm not complaining. I'm doing what I like to do. So
exactly.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But yeah, it was a great experience this time, and you know, it's always really tricky doing a book adaptation. You know, it's not easy at all.
Yeah.
But we're slowly veering away from the books a little bit, which we have to do.
You have to do that, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting because here's another example is the Game of Thrones stuff.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so I read all the books.
Oh,
I was
really?
Excited.
So interesting.
Yeah. Totally. And I was watching the series and I was like, the first part of it was like, well, this is exactly like the book.
Yeah.
Literally exactly.
Really?
And then so by the end that people were catching on that they got to change it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to be like I'm just watching a video or reenactment of what I'm reading.
Right, right.
And so they have to change it because it makes it more interesting. And they're like, oh, but they changed it. And it's like, yes, of course they did.
Yes, they need to.
They need to.
Yeah, not only that, but you know, especially our books because, you know, they're obviously written for younger kids. And, you know, in the first movie, we stuck to the books pretty closely because all we had was the book fans.
Right.
It wasn't a huge popular book or anything. It wasn't like The Hunger Games.
Right.
You know, so we had to kind of, you know, we probably stuck to the book to a fault, to be honest. It probably hurt us in places.
Yeah.
Especially towards the end.
But okay, so it's not necessarily hugely popular. So those who haven't seen it are like, they're enjoying it, right?
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is that the books surged after the movie came out.
All right.
Because, you know, the movie basically, it earned 10 times its budget.
Right.
You know, we made $340 million globally off of a $34 million movie.
Right.
It was the studio's most profitable movie that year.
Wow.
Because we're such a low-budget movie.
Right.
And that's why on the next one, we had a little bit more this time.
Right.
Just a little bit. But we're still, both movies combined are still less than most first movies. So
right.
It's actually a good deal for Fox.
Right.
But now we've got a lot more movie fans, and we have to kind of make sure that we're more focused on making a good movie rather than just adapting the stories. You know? And so if things don't quite work and they don't translate well to the cinematic aspect of things, then we have to change it. You know, and it's become, and fortunately the author's really cool. He's up for that. He's a movie geek himself, so he understands, you know.
Is he contributing to the script as well a little bit?
No, more of just a
consultant kind of?
Yeah, like, here's what we want to do. Are you okay with that? And he's like, yeah, dude, this is great.
Okay, great.
But, you know, ultimately, it's like, it really does have to be just me and the writer and just
of course, you guys have a vision in your mind.
Too many cooks in the kitchen, it's going to unravel very quickly.
Yeah. You're just going to say, listen, we're going to change the plot a little bit.
Yeah, basically, yeah. But it's been a really fun experience, man. I feel like I've won the lottery, to be honest.
It's been great. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with talent, but I know sometimes when it's happening to you.
The truth is, though, talent only counts for so much.
Yeah, but you know what? You also went into that room and it worked, right?
Yeah. So yeah, we got in the chair. Yeah. They gave me the shot, and then I didn't screw it up yet.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Well, I really, really appreciate you being able to come by
and talk about this stuff. This is fun.
This was really cool. Right? We always end by saying we're going to let the last bucket drop, but I don't know. Was Scanline a bucket renderer or not? Did it do buckets?
It did. Yeah. Moto did buckets.
Right. So when you see that last bucket and you're waiting for it to drop, that's the sign off on a podcast.
Last bucket drop, baby.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right, thanks. Appreciate it, Wes.